said, I never said that. thank you for the opportunity to be with you this morning. It's always a pleasure to talk to so many people who are actively working on making our built environment, our towns and cities, safer, more sustainable, more prosperous. I was pleased to hear Karen's presentation, and I had the pleasure this morning to spend some time with Isabel, who I think you've already heard from. And so I know you are already having some quite rich conversations about the really big urban issues that we're all grappling with. I wanted to give you a bit of an overview of our government's direction of travel on these issues, and to start by saying that there are three underlying themes that run through a lot of the work we're doing that I think will resonate with your discussions today. The first is the imperative to integrate transport thinking into all of our land use, housing and urban development work. I'm in a kind of unique situation to appreciate this, having responsibility in our government for both transport and housing and urban development. And this is an opportunity that I don't intend to let slip through our grasp, to really make progress on breaking down the silos and ensuring that we're not only thinking and planning, but working and delivering in a really joined up way. And I think that if we do this, it will release huge new value into the system. The second is that transport planning is critical to supporting the kind of urban growth and the growth of our towns and cities that we want. And I put it that way because the opportunity that we have is to think about the kinds of towns and cities that we want, the communities and neighbourhoods, and then investment planning accordingly with transport and planning and housing and all of the other interventions to deliver on that vision. We don't have to think that these forces are just acts of God and that we're kind of buffeted by economic and social forces that shape our cities. We can exercise some agency, and it's about having that vision and then crafting policies to deliver on. And a couple of examples, you know, if we want quality urban intensification in our cities, we have to plan and build the transport and transit systems to support that kind of urban growth. If we don't want isolated, car-dependent communities on the fringes of our cities that are not properly served by infrastructure, then we have to invest in transport infrastructure to support growth on the fringes and plan accordingly. The third point, by way of introduction, is really to say that new approaches to transport are critically important to supporting our 21st century urban development model. What we have in our larger towns and cities is a legacy of a mid-20th century development model. Low-rise, low-density suburban expansion supported by roads and motorways. It won't work in the 21st century, and we see signs of that in our larger and high-growth cities. And what we have to do now is really shift gear to a development model that will meet the needs, the aspirations of our community for the kind of living that people want. And that means in our largest cities, we have to urgently reverse the legacy effects of decades of underinvestment in public transport. And we have to encourage the kind of development of the communities, the housing, kinds of housing, and prices people can afford in places where they want to live. And we've got to build transport systems to support that. And that means a very different looking urban environment. So our vision for the transport system is that we want a system that is designed for people, not just cars. One that accommodates new and emerging forms of transport and services, and one that puts safety as the top priority. From motorways that cut through the heart of the city to a parking lot that takes up valuable space on our waterfront, there has in the past been a huge focus in our urban development on placing private cars and vehicles at the forefront of our planning and investment. We need to put people at the forefront. For too long we prioritised the movement of cars and devoted the best of our urban real estate to either the driving of cars or the parking of cars. And the world has changed, and we have to change our practices now to respond to that. We want a system that provides people and businesses with much greater choice in how they travel and move goods. If you like reading transport planning documents, have a look at our government policy statement on transport, which we released last year. It's the high-level statement of policy direction on transport. It's renewed every 3 years. It's got a 10-year horizon. And you'll see that we've recast the entire transport policy around the idea of access. Giving Kiwis access to the things that they need. Work, education, community, family is the main organising principle in the entire transport strategy. And it's a big shift from the notion that our transport thinking should be designed around building roads and motorways and reducing journey time on particular corridors. The high-level goal is access to the things that we need. And what we know in the 21st century is that there's a whole lot of ways that you can deliver that. So I mentioned integration of transport and land use planning. And this is central to our thinking. I want to give you three examples of how we see this new approach can play out. And one of them is some work that we're doing to build out the rapid transit network in Auckland. You've heard us talking about the light rail project there. We're interested in rapid transit, not just in Auckland, in a number of other cities, but just to go with this Auckland example, our aim is to build two light rail lines that will add to the existing rapid transit network that consists of the incredibly successful Northern Busway that now brings in almost as many people into the city every morning from the northern suburbs as do travel by private car, and the existing heavy rail network. That is, in a few years' time, with the completion of the City Rail Link, going to double its carrying capacity. And trains will be able to travel every few minutes through dozens of stations and town centres on the heavy rail network. We want to add these two light rail lines really to provide the trunk architecture, the rapid transit trunk architecture of a 21st century public transport system. We know that investment in high quality transit is a massive stimulus to housing and investment and urban development. And so what we're going to do is along these rapid transit corridors, we're going to use the new urban development authority that we're setting up to create in a walking radius of every station that will effectively create a corridor that the urban development authority is going to invest in and manage the infrastructure, the RMA planning, public realm, all of the things that are needed to optimise the development outcomes and encourage high quality, high amenity urban intensification along these transport corridors. And this is a central part of our vision to unleash the market for quality intensification in the city, because we think that will deliver more and better housing options for people, that will improve the public realm, the quality of the urban environment, and help Auckland to accommodate the huge growth pressures that it's experiencing. So that's one example. Another is that Karen mentioned spatial planning, and it's something that it's one of the spatial planning is one of the five pillars of our urban growth agenda, and we believe that government, central government and local government and other stakeholders, iwi and others, can work together to do collaborative regional spatial planning exercises that will really add value to our urban development and regional growth. And one of the areas where we've started work on this is in the Waikato-Auckland corridor, which is, as you know, it's part of the country that's experiencing a huge share of the nation's population and economic growth. Hamilton is the trajectory for Hamilton is for it to be one of our major urban centres. The southern corridor around Auckland also is one of the really big high growth areas. They're both in the Golden Triangle, and we are working with the councils both in Auckland and through all of them, the councils through the Waikato and Mata Whenua at the moment on some regional spatial planning exercises that transcend the local government's boundaries, that have a long time frame, that are expansive in scope, and that have transport planning at the core of them. And so both in the southern growth corridor of Auckland and in the sort of metro Hamilton Waikato area, we're looking at transit-based architecture, a change in the way that we plan urban expansion, and then looking at how through modern rail connections we can unite those two critically important labour markets. And that's a big part of our sort of big picture plan that we've got to try and sort out Auckland's growth challenges. The third example is a bit more micro, and that is one of our early sites for this new approach to project-based approach to urban development is at the Unitech site in Carrington Road in Mount Albert, where we purchased 30 hectares of land. It's a gorgeous site right in the middle of Auckland's isthmus, and it has fantastic transport connections. So it's going to have heavy rail at one end, at the Mount Albert Railway Station, light rail at Point Chevy. It's already bounded by great walking and cycling tracks on all sides, and a major bus route down Carrington Road. And we're going to use this as a showcase of a contemporary urban eco-community with the best transport connections. And it'll be a kind of community where I think many people will choose to either reduce the number of cars that their family owns or not own a car at all, and take advantage of the fantastic rapid transit, public transport, walking and cycling, and car sharing, ride sharing, and all the other things that are part of the new urban transport environment. So what else is government doing in this area? I've mentioned walking and cycling a few times now, and greater investment in the infrastructure that will support safer walking and cycling in our cities is a really important part of our policy. When the Ministry of Transport surveyed household travel last year, fewer than 10% of short trips were made by walking, cycling and public transport combined. We're coming off a low base, but when you look at the trend data of places where governments, our government and the government for increased investment in walking and cycling infrastructure, when you build good infrastructure, people will use it, and we're seeing some very exciting increase in uptake. I don't need to tell you about the massive public health benefits of walking and cycling and public transport. That's a huge benefit overall. It will make our cities not only healthier but happier places to live. And walking and cycling is a really important contribution to the first and last mile. If we want people to use public transport, really good walking and cycling that helps them get to and from the stations is essential. So we're investing $4 billion in public transport at the moment, a really big increase on what was there before. We've got $390 million invested in walking and cycling over the next 3 years, so north of $900 million over this 10-year period. Public transport is also very, very important in our scheme of things. And as I said, what we're doing now is really retrofitting in our largest cities modern rapid transit and public transport systems in order to take us away from the extreme levels of car dependency and congestion that are a feature of that mid-20th century development model. If we don't urgently invest in better, more frequent services, better customer service, more efficiently managed transport networks, and more infrastructure, then we'll never, ever turn around the worsening urban congestion that we've got. And building better walking, cycling infrastructure, and better public transport services is the way that we will give people genuine choices and the opportunity to have a congestion-free option for their commute. I don't need to explain to you the importance of induced demand. The idea that if you add further lanes and capacity, if you treat the road system like if your analogy is it's like a water network just running capacity through the pipes, the more you add that capacity, the more those lanes and those motorways and roads are going to fill up. And I think that's been a really big psychological shift in the public in recent years, particularly in Auckland, where people realise that, notwithstanding the success of the Waterview Tunnel, people realise that we can't build our way out of this challenge simply by adding lanes and adding more motorways. We have to build a more diverse, more intelligent, more responsive transport network. Someone was explaining to me the other day, this is one for the transport nerds in the room. Are there transport nerds in the room? Yeah, I thought so. Someone was explaining the Moggridge principle to me. Does anyone know the Moggridge principle? Yes. All right, I'm going to explain the Moggridge principle. It's kind of a little, it's a slightly different spin on induced demand, but it's about the speed of your roading networks in relation to the speed of your public transport networks. One of the biggest indicators of congestion and slow journey times on the road is the speed of your public transport networks. If your public transport networks offer very slow journeys and long journey times, people will desert public transport and take the road. And what happens when more and more people do that? The roads fill up and the journey times go down on your roading network. And it will reach a natural equilibrium. If you can speed up the journey times on your public transport network, some people will leave their cars at home and choose the public transport. And that will then speed up journey times on the roads. So I wanted to share that with you. That's something I just learned. And I think it's a pretty good illustration of why we need to build fully joined up, fully integrated systems that include roads and motorways, of course, but really good rapid transit and public transport systems alongside. One of the things I think that brings together so many of the strands of our transport policy and for our towns and cities is this idea of mode shift, of encouraging people to leave their central occupant vehicles at home and choose to travel in a number of different ways. Public transport, walking and cycling, mobility as a service, working from home, choosing to time their work and their journeys in order to minimise the congestion. The indicator, I think, that brings all these things together is mode shift. And I've asked Transport Agency to sit down with councils and our six big metros and pull together everything that they're doing into a mode shift plan for their city. It's a different and new way of doing things, and it's asking the New Zealand Transport Agency to no longer think of itself as just a funder of projects and a builder
system. And what we're trying to do is change human behaviour by providing people better options for health services. And it requires central government to work in a very tight collaboration with local government and, in fact, the broader transport community to achieve these outcomes. So my hope is that these mode shift plans will set some ambitious targets. They'll be backed by actual programs of delivery of services and in various interventions in the transport system. So I hope to have more to say about that publicly in the coming months. And I hope we can communicate the high-level goals in a way that help us to take the public with us on this journey and see that there's a strategy here and a vision that will get us through the next 5 years, the next 10 years, the next 20 years, and make our cities much more livable and prosperous. Let me touch on a few other big brush strokes in our policy. We are committed to and working towards a mode-neutral approach to freight transport. It's our view that a heavily roads and motorway-centric approach to shifting freight around the country is better. We're simply not getting the economic value that we should out of rail and coastal shipping. We've got this amazing sunk asset in the national railway network, but it's been in a state of managed decline for a long, long time. It's been treated as a silo completely outside the National Land Transport Program, which is the funding, planning, and decision-making system for land transport. So we're bringing rail in, and our intention is to get KiwiRail on a much stronger footing financially and to fully integrate it into our transport planning and decision making system, so that when we're considering a particular task, a particular problem, transport problem, that the transport planners will go, okay, let's just not default to building a new four-lane expressway between A and B. Let's think about the transport problem and challenges around here and think about what are the range of possible interventions that will fix this problem in a sustainable way. We also want to price in things that have been treated as academic externalities. Carbon emissions, deaths and serious injuries, public health, the effect on the quality of our places, our neighbourhoods, and our suburbs and towns and cities. These are things that we want to bring into the system and price them properly so that the transport decision makers can make fully informed decisions in a mode neutral way. Safety has been elevated under our government to being one of the top level priorities. It's one of two of the top high level goals. The number of people who are dying and being maimed on our roads every year is a scandal problem that has been allowed. The numbers have been ballooning in recent years. We are being left way behind compared to a number of other countries in the world that we commonly compare ourselves to. And so, under the leadership of my Associate Minister Julian Jenton, we've got a really big and ambitious safety program that will be unveiling in the coming months that deals with everything from all of the regulatory issues, the way we invest the design of the road network, and a number of other things. So we are currently investing $4.3 billion into programs and projects that are about reducing deaths and serious injuries. And you'll know from some of the announcements we've made in recent months that our focus is now much more on a clinical identification of where we can invest to prevent deaths and serious injuries from the road network right across the entire roading system. Not doing as the old regime did, which is build very small bits of high-speed four-lane dual-carriage expressways around our major urban centres. Motorways that carry, in the last 9 years, 4% of vehicle journeys. But each year, more than one-third of the entire transport budget. So we're taking a very different approach. We're looking across the entire road network, state highways and local roads, face as urban designers and transport planners and engineers is knowing how to plan and build the future that we want for our towns and cities, places that we all want to live and move and plan. So planning is key, and the impacts of the decisions that we make as policymakers and planners and investors stay with us for decades. And I think have a major long-run impact on the economic efficiency and quality of our communities. So these issues that we're talking about are of critical importance. We also need to be prepared for the technological changes. So it's not just the demographic forces that are reshaping our towns and cities. Technology and new models of service and business are also having a big impact. And I thought I'd just mention the three biggies that I think are on the horizon for us. One is the electrification of the vehicle fleet to reduce our carbon footprint. And this includes the entire fleet, so cars, buses, delivery vehicles, bikes, even scooters. The decarbonisation of our transport economy is the challenge that we have. It's going to happen. The question is, how quickly will it happen? And how do we do it in a way that we get the best outcomes as soon as possible for the best cost? The other one is that as we transition to an electric fleet, we'll have to find a replacement to the way that we currently raise the revenue for our transport system. It's mostly through fuel excise duty. And I think that that raises what is both surely a huge opportunity but a huge challenge at the same time. I think all of the pointers directing us towards a comprehensive satellite and GPS-based transport pricing system. Now, if we can achieve that mind-boggling transition, it offers wonderful opportunities for us, not only for sustainable revenue generation, but it would provide us with a highly tooled way of managing demand that's smoothing off the congestion peaks in our larger urban centres. So demand management, which we have to find a way of reaching, and I think pricing is the ultimately the way that we'll do that. But also potentially a comprehensive transport pricing system offers the wonderful possibility that we can price different moments of transport against each other. And it's also a way ultimately that we can price in the true costs of dispersed urban development. And at the moment, every time we build a road, a motorway extension out into the countryside, it's a massive mask subsidy for dispersed development. That's one of the big challenges that we've got. So let me finish there. I hope I've given you a kind of a wide-ranging snapshot of the direction of policy, and I hope that it has been a kind of useful contribution to the rest of your discussions today. And unless I'm told that we'll leave immediately, I'd be very happy to have some questions. Thank you.
We might have to shoot off, but
in that case, I can just walk with you.
So, if anybody's got one for the minister here, please let us know. Oh, yes, straight there, nice and close. Good.
Minister, thank you for a very interesting talk. I'm Isabel Hawthorne from Purira. I'm interested in your thoughts as a minister in dealing with the fact that your government is seeking to turn the container ship around, if you will. You've spoken about how significant that changes. Are there any thoughts on the way that we currently structure that whole system from funding all the way down through what ends up on the ground so that we can perhaps change a little more quickly? The missionary government is probably the thing I'm interested in, and what was appropriate for a minister to be filling with that stuff in our independent public service.
So I'm already in the thick of a massive machinery of government reform project in the housing movement development, which has been about trying to build the capacity within the system to deliver on our, I think, what is a very ambitious reform agenda. And actually what the direction we're going with that is taking a leaf out of the book of the transport sector, where you've got a policy design oversight ministry, a pretty all-inclusive operational delivery agency, the transport agency, with a way of working which is about engaging with quite a universe of different stakeholders, including especially local government, I suppose, with central government delivering a GPS, some high-level policy direction every 3 years. I think that's a pretty good model, and with transport, I think the challenges for us are about the content, the way we think about these issues, the way we, it's not the machinery government, I think, that needs to change. And the big qualitative shift that we're looking for is this move towards mode neutrality, to integrating transport thinking right into the heart of urban development and urban growth planning. We, to give you an example of it, the Ministry and NZTA are embarking on a massive exercise to completely rethink all of their machinery for assessing and measuring the value of transport investments. Because, they administer a system which is like a giant cat sort of inventory system of projects and interventions, and rationing those across space and time to try to deliver the best outcomes for the dollars that we've got. And the old system was based on a very crude and narrow way of measuring the value of projects. And we've said to them in the GPS, that's got to change. We need this much more expansive, multi-dimensional way of assessing the value of projects against each other. And so those are the big qualitative shifts. So it's not about changing the structures, machinery of government, but it is a radical change in the way that we work.
Thank you very much, the Honourable Phil Twyford, Minister.